Good afternoon. My name is Jackie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the AAAS Science Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you have already done so, please press the pound sign now. Then press star one again to ensure your question is registered. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Penholster with AAAS, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Jackie. I'm delighted to be hosting this science teleconference from Vancouver, Canada, where I'm planning for the 2012 AAAS annual meeting. I wanted to thank my hosts here at the University of British Columbia, Ryan, Lynn, Chris, Balma, and their colleagues. And I also wanted to mention, by the way, for reporters on the line, if you've not yet saved the date for the next AAAS annual meeting, please be sure to mark your calendars for February 16th through the 20th. It really is a phenomenal city, and I think this is the meeting you won't want to miss. But let's begin. This event has been organized by the American Association for the Advancement of Science in collaboration with UBC. We're going to talk about a research article forthcoming in this Friday's edition of the journal Science entitled Improved Learning in a Large Enrollment Physics Class. All information disclosed during this event will remain under embargo until 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, Thursday, May the 12th. Our speakers today will be the authors on this paper, Nobel laureate Dr. Carl Wieman, the Associate Director for Science of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Dr. Wieman is on leave from the University of British Columbia and the University of Colorado at Boulder. He is a professor of physics at both institutions, and he also serves as the director of the science education initiatives at both institutions. He is joined by Dr. Louis DeLoria, a postdoctoral fellow with the Carl Wieman Science Education Initiative at UBC, and Ms. Ellen Chalou, a master's student here at UBC's Department of Physics. Each speaker will offer brief commentary and then answer questions. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Wieman. Sir?
Thank you. So just a few key points about this study that I think are particularly notable is, first, it's just a particularly clean comparison. We had one, the control group instructor was someone who was highly motivated, well-experienced, and had good student evaluations. There was a great deal of careful data collected showing how identical the two sections, these two large sections of this class were beforehand. And this focused very much on looking at exactly what could be learned with the different methods from the classroom experience, that time when you have the maximum student instructor interaction or face-to-face interaction time. So that's sort of the first point, is the cleanliness of the comparison, I think. The second is that this instruction was done not by highly experienced instructors, which is many teaching innovations are carried out that way. It's just part of the research of the people doing it. But rather, the work was really all done by Ellen and Louis, who are very thoughtful people, but they're not experienced physics teachers. But what they were, what they did have for them is they were trained in the certain practices and principles of effective teaching, and I did that training of them, but then it was carried out by them. So it really shows that it's nothing magical about a particular person. It's something you really can learn, it's not trivial, but it's relatively straightforward to learn, so any teacher could do this, I think. A third important point is that when you look at these results and the comparison histogram, it makes it very clear that the form of teaching here was much more effective for all of the students, that the entire distribution of students is moved up there's almost nobody from the control class that would even be average in the experimental course. And finally, most of the, not all of the instructional practices used in this course were things that other people have developed and demonstrated are effective. To a large extent, what was done here was getting very clean data on it. But I guess I think that probably there was some gain also to the fact of really working to fit all of these different instructional practices together in this coherent framework of really maximum student time spent in this practicing expert thinking and maximum feedback to the students from their own interactions and from the instructor, and really so no pre-prepared lecturing by the instructors at all. And I think those are kind of, from my point, the main messages or main important features from this, in addition, of course, such a large difference between the two sections that was observed. So, Louis and Ellen, you want to add some things?
Sure. For me, the main thing that inspired me to set up this study was the intriguing possibility of being able to isolate the amount of learning that takes place in the classroom during a lecture and measure this learning for two different instructional approaches, where one of them is the common traditional lecture method that most of us have experienced in school. Before this particular study and since then, I have personally been involved in several course transformations, which typically span a whole semester as opposed to 1 week in this case. And in all these other cases, although we also measured increased learning, it's not always clear which aspects of the course during the whole semester contributed most to learning. So it's this ability in our study and being able to measure the learning that takes place in the classroom that's really exciting to me. Teaching the experimental section during the study was a lot of fun for Ellen and I. The energy in the class and the excitement of the students makes for a great learning environment. However, one of the consequences of having students work in groups on carefully designed activities and being in this kind of active learning environment is a direct increase in the sophistication of their questions. So, as an instructor, you really have to be on your toes. And as far as the faculty is concerned here in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at UBC, they have responded quite well to the results in this study. In fact, all section instructors, and that amounts for 9 instructors, for our two largest first-year physics courses have, in fact, agreed to transform their course in the same way we did for this study. Ellen, do you want to add something?
Thanks, Lee. I'm just going to add a couple points. So compared to a traditionally taught class, the students are much more engaged and invested in their learning. Students aren't just going through the motions of writing out a solution to a problem, as can be a typical part of traditional lecturing. Their brains are turned on, they're thinking hard, and they're really working through these problems. So even if they don't have enough time to complete a given problem, they are prepared to learn from the instructor feedback that always follows groups' tasks. They're ready to get the most out of this feedback. Students recognize that they're learning more, and despite the fact that they have to put in extra effort each class, they are enjoying themselves. And that's it.
Okay. Well, thank you, speakers and operator. I think we're ready to accept questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Seth Bornstein with Associated Press.
Thank you for doing this. I guess this is for both Carl and either Ellen or Louis. Since this is sort of new, you know, for those of us who are much older and much more with a few years from college, can you describe? From the paper, it seems like the clicker system is almost a Jeopardy meets MTV. You know, you're looking at 3 minutes, 6 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, very short attention span things, and then you've got the clicker, which is like a remote control. I mean, how would you describe this learning method to someone who has never used it? I mean, would I be fair to describe it that way? And I have a follow-up question.
No, I don't think it's quite fair to describe it that way. It's really not that it's little short intervals. I mean, we sort of describe it in the paper to give a sense of how it progresses through material, but in fact, many times, you know, you'll have a question or you'll have a task for the students, which will be followed by many minutes of questions from students, elaboration by the instructor, and so on. And the clickers are really just kind of a means of triggering people to think hard about something. They have to commit to an answer that then they can go back and see if they got it right. So I guess I don't really think of it so much as little tiny pieces. In fact, in many respects, these kind of things flow in a more intellectually continuous way than a regular lecture course would.
So is there a better way, I mean, besides, for someone who hasn't experienced this, how you would describe the use of the clickers with the, you know, then the results going up on screen behind you? I mean, is it...
Yeah, we've actually worked in these, in our science education niches, we worked a lot on developing the effective use of clickers and what works best. And in fact, if they're, it's not very effective, but this is the way faculty first start out when they're kind of novices at using them. R is just kind of a quick test, and you see the results, and then you kind of go on. The effective use is really just as a little piece of technology that facilitates communication. And so it just kind of, I mean, if somebody has to answer a question in which they're accountable for, you know, the computer knows, so the instructor knows what they chose, psychologically you process things differently, and you're much better prepared to learn. That's just kind of some basic psychological response. And so the clicker, when it's used effectively, is just kind of a way to facilitate communication, and it's quite important in the use of them that the instructor makes it clear to the students that that's what they are. They're not an attendance device or a testing device so much as a communication device, a way for the instructor to know more about what the students are getting and not getting, and a way to kind of focus the students' attention on particular questions they should be thinking about.
And to follow up, what about long-term? I mean, you have the results from the testing, you know, that are in Figure 1 there. But what about, have you gone back 2 months later, 3 months later, to see if the results are any different in terms of long-term recall?
Not for this particular study, because it was, you know, jumping into the middle of, I mean, that's one of the things that made it interesting, is kind of jumping into the middle of another class, you know, a class being taught by regular instructors and so on. Louis and I have some other people, but Louis and I have done one study that looked at retention. But Louis, was it 6 months and 18 months later you've got that data on?
That's correct.
Yeah. Where it wasn't quite the same kind of learning here, but we were testing retention of kind of conceptual knowledge, which I think of as kind of the expert thinking we tried to push in this class here. And that's actually, the editor said we had to put in a reference to that paper, even though, so one of the early references to the paper are to that study, and it did show high levels of retention of this kind of expert thinking, which is, it's a little different from what happened in this particular class, but it does suggest that this kind of deep, engaged student thinking does lead to a lot better recall than a lot of the normal sort of studying and processing students do. Or, not recall, retention.
And if I may add something,
sure.
But these, you know, teaching practices that personally I have learned from Carl and the Science Education Initiative, students, as opposed to in a traditional lecturing style where students are passive, in the active type of interactive engagement, students, you know, take time to go through, you know, this very difficult phase of trying to synthesize the information and incorporating it into a mental model. So once they do that, then the information which would otherwise appear to a novice, a student, like a bunch of phone numbers, which they would forget quite readily, then when it's incorporated into a mental model, which we really stress always, then that, as Carl said, that we found that students have much, much, much better retention over even up to a year and a half after the learning period.
But at the same time, you know, the retention studies have been very limited, so I don't want to make grand claims. You know, the evidence, there's some evidence, but it's far from complete. Much more work needs to go into that, I think.
Okay, operator, I think we're ready for our next call.
Your next question comes from the line of Jeffrey Mervis with Science Magazine.
Hi, Carl and Louis. I had a couple of deep specific questions, and then a more general question also, like Seth. Was the instructor a tenured professor?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
When you say the instructor, you mean the control, the controlling?
Yeah, instructor A.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
Long tenured.
All right. And was the low overall attendance disappointing? I noticed that you had only 171 students in the control section take the test, which is like 100 less than the enrollment.
That's right.
I mean, was that normal?
Yeah. In fact,
for attendance at in first-year physics classes?
Unfortunately, yes. absolutely. So we did measure engagement before that, you know, that study during that 13th week of the term. And the attendance, I'm sorry, in the control section and the other section that we were about to take over was the same. And, you know, it was about 55%. And in the control section, of course, the instructional approach did not change. So it was not so surprising to see the attendance remain more or less the same. But in the experimental section, as I think you noted, the you know, it went up to 75%. So... but yes, I felt like you had some, you know, some questions about the fact that the number was low, and were you wondering if it affects the results in any way?
Well, no, I was actually more just thinking in terms, since the goal of it is to increase learning, that even under the best of circumstances, you're only reaching 3/4 of the students in the class.
Yes.
Just because the rest of them don't come.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, those numbers are pretty typical, but I think, you know, the reality is that students don't come because there's better ways they can spend their time. I mean, you know, look at what they learn from from a good traditional lecture. You know, that's not very much. And so, anyway, so the numbers, we've got lots of data on this. The numbers aren't unusual, yeah.
Okay, and could you talk a little bit about the broader issue of course transformations? How widespread is it at UBC? How many classes are you now into where you have the instructors changing their approach?
So I don't, I can't give you the exact numbers now because I haven't been there, you know, running things for almost a year. But
okay.
The initiative that we started there was to work on, you know, whole departments transforming, and it's been there's been a ramping up process across various departments. So the one that sort of started the earliest was the Earth Notion Sciences, and it's gone through most of its undergraduate courses now, certainly all the large core ones. And then the others are at, the other departments are at different stages, but there's a significant number. My wife has taken over running things there, and she could give you the exact numbers.
Okay.
I'm afraid I don't have them. But.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to sort of get the context for this.
Yeah. I do know the numbers from Colorado because I've just sent them. They're Colorado, where it was a similar program we started, although it had half the money, and so it was somewhat smaller scale. After 5 years, it's transformed 55 courses, which is a pretty big chunk of
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Joe Hall with Toronto Star.
Well, hi. Thanks for doing this. I was wondering if you believe this could translate into other disciplines in science and maybe even into things in the arts and humanities. Would this technique be portable that way?
So, in the sciences, absolutely. We're already doing that. I mean, we and others, but certainly in the science education initiative, it's just systematically going through the different sciences. Other people have aspects of these approaches, and they certainly would work just the same. And we've got data from classrooms showing that. The farther away you get from the science, kind of the less certain I am. I'm pretty confident that in the social sciences, I sort of see how you'd do the same things there. And certainly the basic design principle of this kind of deliberate practice, expert thinking and getting and frequent feedback, that's all based on principles and research from cognitive psychology that they sort of look at expertise of all kinds that go into that. So you can go a fair distance there. Once you start getting into, you know, art and English literature and some things like that, I have my suspicions it would work, but I'm not willing to make much in the way of claims because it's getting pretty different kinds of ways of thinking and teaching. So.
Can I ask another question? You said that you're looking at what these kids are learning from good traditional lectures, and you say that's not very much. Is there any sense in continuing those kinds of traditional lectures as part of the main part of the curriculum?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I mean, you said the kids aren't getting much from traditional lectures. I mean, is there any sense in continuing to put them through that tedium when they're not getting anything out of it?
No. I mean, you know, that's what this study shows, is that there's a lot better way to do things, and people should be should be faculty ought to all be switching over to.
What are you going to do with all these tenured professors then?
Well, I think they, you know, they can learn. That's part of what the science education initiatives at Colorado and UBC were targeting, was you've got tenured faculty. You want to help them to see better how to teach in different ways and how to be effective that way. And you want to get data like this to show them that that they can be much more effective. I mean, you know, they're not stupid people. They if they see that the students can learn a great deal more, you know, if they teach differently, and they see the students will be a lot more engaged and interested in coming to class, you know, they decide they'll change. Like Louis says, there's been a whole bunch of faculty in the UBC physics department that he's working with now that have changed over. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Roseanne Scorble of Voice of America.
Yeah, I just would like a clearer picture of actually what's happening in this test classroom where the teachers are changing their teaching style. If you could tell me what is happening. I just came in and I wasn't able to read the paper beforehand, so I don't understand about the clicker thing either. And as a former teacher, I'm really interested to know exactly what's happening in this classroom and what is the teaching style that's being used.
Hey, Louis, go ahead. You were doing it, so.
Sure. Well, I guess the best way to grasp sort of the first order feeling as to what happened in the experimental section, it would be good to contrast it with the traditional lecturing approach that was in the control section. So in this case, if we look at what students were actually doing in the control section, you know, they were passive the whole time. Information was coming at them, and if you will, at best, you know, the students would try to follow, but they would not be given time to stop and really make the effort to try to synthesize all these ideas. Whereas in the experimental section, there was very little lecturing. So the students came to class prepared, and at the beginning they were presented some of these ideas, and then right away these complex tasks that we wanted students to be able to achieve by the end of the lecture, we broke them down, just like a good coach, we broke them down into smaller, manageable tasks, and students worked on this in groups, and they acquired some expertise for those smaller tasks, and then hopefully by the end of the lecture, as we start integrating those various components together, then students would find themselves being able to do more complicated things. And you mentioned clickers. So clickers, as Carl said earlier, they're just a convenient means to provide feedback for the students and also for the instructor. You know, instead of clickers, we could use cards, or students could raise their hands. But clickers just make it more efficient. That's all. You ask them a very good question that's often based on known student difficulties and misconceptions, and students turn to their peers and they try to critique their own reasoning and the reasoning of their peers, and they attempt an answer. As Carl said, when students have to commit to an answer, they take some ownership. So that provides extra motivation for them to really make the effort there. So and then the instructor shows what the correct answer was and provides appropriate feedback.
I chime in one thing to note. So Louis talks about these different tasks they're working on. So some of these are clicker questions. Some of them are little worksheets that they write things down on. And they're doing these things. They have to have some. They do them there's some individual accountability. The clicker provides that. The handing in the individual worksheets provide that. But they're talking to each other, working in groups as they're doing that. But one important point that Bowie didn't mention is that while they're doing all that, the instructor is wandering around, listening in on those discussions that the students are having with themselves and their peers, and so the instructor knows much more about what they're understanding and not understanding, and then in the follow-up discussion, make sure and covers those points. So that instructor kind of listening in is a critically important aspect.
How many students were in each of these sections?
Ellen's going to tackle that.
So the number of students enrolled in both sections, there were 267 enrolled in the control section and 271 in the experiment section.
And they were able to walk around the classroom and of 200 students in groups and manage.
So during the experiment, there were Louis and I who were circulating the classroom. But maybe Louis can add how many people you typically have in the transformed classes at UBC.
Well, I just wanted the question to be clarified, if that's okay. So you're asking, typically in a transformed course, what's the percentage attendance? Or I'm not sure.
No, I was just curious. I mean, a 1 to 200 teacher-to-student ratio is pretty hefty. And I just was wondering how many students you were working with at a time.
Oh, okay. I think I understand the question. I think the key point is that, I mean, what the research has shown us is that you don't have 200 different ways of thinking about this. You actually only have, you know, maybe, you know, well, there's one or two correct ways to think about something, and maybe three or four incorrect ways that, and so these things are very common, and so you can listen in and only sample a small subset of the full 270 and actually have a very good idea of then what are the issues for all of the others. And I mean I think the results sort of support that, obviously, but that's really a key aspect, is that this small sampling allows you to know what almost every student in the class, not individually but collectively, what they're thinking about the subject.
So I'm just trying to think of it from the teacher's point of view and working with the students.
Yeah.
And go on.
Well, the point is that it does... I mean, in some ways, this is leveraging, so you're getting kind of individualized attention without individualized interaction, in that, you know, they bring out the different student points of view are brought out and examined both by the students talking to each other and the instructor going over them, and so that even though you're back in the far left corner, there's a very high probability of some particular thing you were thinking about, the instructor or another student will say, will directly address your concerns, and so it's...
Just one final question. I'll let someone else ask some questions. Do you think that this method could be used? A lot of students now are enrolling in online courses. They're more popular. They're cheaper. And do you think this kind of transformational teaching can take place online?
One of the key aspects of this is both the student very actively mentally engaged, but the second, and I think in principle you could do that online, but the second part of the feedback that guides thinking, which is, you know, that cognitive psychologists and lots of research have shown is really an important element. It's very hard to see how to do that as effectively online. And maybe people will do it someday, but I really am not sure how you'd make that happen because, you know, in the classroom, the student is getting lots of feedback through their discussions with each other, you know, of confirmation or questioning. And then they also get this frequent and, you know, much more specific feedback from the instructor because he's busy listening in on these conversations. And so it's not nearly so clear to me how you could capture that really important element from online instruction.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Ben Carey with New York Times.
Oh, hello. I have a question about controls. How do we know that these effects that you've measured aren't due either to the, you know, the different teachers, because you're introducing new teachers kind of all of a sudden in class 12, or to differences in the two classes? After all, one is being taught by instructor A and another by B, so they've been prepared differently. Or, for that matter, to the homework. You've given them a lot more homework. And especially since 100 of the students in the control class didn't show.
But they also didn't take the test. So.
Right. Okay. But those are the things, though. I mean, it's not controlled for teacher or for classroom or for amount of work assigned. And I wonder if those could account for any of the effects.
Carl, go ahead.
Go ahead, Louis.
Okay. As far as control is concerned, yes, you know, there were new teachers, Ellen and I. That's true. And, you know, is it possible that, you know, Ellen and I have this this tremendous ability to bring out, you know, the best in the students? I'm not so sure about that. But here's what we know, which actually is unusual. That is the amount of control in this study. So what we do know about the two sections,
yeah,
that is the students that populated them, is quite a bit. Before we came in, they had taken two midterm exams, and the average of these midterm exams were pretty much the same.
What do you mean, pretty much? It was exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So and also we gave some standardized electricity and magnetism diagnostics to both sections the week before Ellen and I came in for the experiment, and they scored the same. What else? Well, there were, you know, there were a slew of other things like this. There are other diagnostics that we gave them where they scored, you know, within a percent of each other. So that actually is rather unusual. So as far as the student population is concerned, that, you know, I would be prepared to say that they were almost identical.
The other thing that Louis didn't mention was that they also measured the attendance before this intervention, and the attendance in the two sections was within the uncertainty was identical. And they also found a way to measure how engaged the students who did come to class, how engaged they were during class, how much time they were spending, you know, text messaging and so on, and that was also measured to be identical. So I think, there was compared to normal evaluations, these two were exceptionally well measured and completely indistinguishable by all these different measures.
Well, I mean, it's not surprising that you get better attendance, it sounds like, because, you know, you change up the teacher. So I can see students saying, well, let's go and find out what's happening. I just wonder whether they were also
I'm guessing. You know, getting to the last quarter of the semester, and
yeah,
of course, people don't go showing up because there might be a different teacher.
Right. But I wonder whether they're more eager to please or trying a little harder or whatever because they've got a sudden change.
In a class of 270?
I think I would like to add that.
You're laughing, but I was a student too once. So, I just wondered why you didn't have the traditional teacher actually. So you wouldn't have a change of teacher. You could actually have the tenured professor give the new instructive approach. What was wrong with that approach? Why don't you do that?
Okay, I can chime in here. There's lots of previous research where, in particularly in physics, but in other disciplines as well, where highly experienced teachers, myself, Eric Mazur at Harvard, whole list of them, who go ahead and measure something, and then we try teaching, and then we figure out different ways to teach, and we do the comparison there and look and see those changes. The problem is that you have other control issues, I'm changing something, there's a inherent bias to want to do better, and you don't know how much that might affect things. So,
right, but at least the teacher is the same.
yeah, but what I'm saying is, so with the same teacher, there's lots of data showing already that, and so this is, not that you don't have a point, that, I mean, it's a good thing to test, but in some sense, that research has already all been done, and so...
Showing significant changes in learning by switching to this Erickson approach.
Yeah.
The same teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, not exactly the Erickson approach, but a more active active and student discussion approaches.
I would just like to add something small here, that as Louis and I were teaching the course, as not perfect instructors, sometimes our instructor feedback would be a little bit long-winded and closer to almost a lecturing style of teaching. And at those times, we would notice that the engagement in the class did decrease.
Right, no doubt. I mean, it sounds great. It's just because you've got such a radical change in teachers, I mean, that could account for the effect. That's all.
I think the other thing is that, again, that just the background research literature shows that people who that the effect of teachers certainly at the university level is quite small compared to how the pedagogical approach they take, and that's not something that people in see as an intuitive thing, but that's what the data really shows quite compellingly. And in fact, the data from this experiment showed that in some ways, in that when they carried out this experiment, those two sections were taught by two teachers with rather different personalities, they used the same basic lecture approach, and there was this enormous amount of data on attendance, engagement, all the test scores, etc., that came out exactly the same between those two. And so that's just kind of another in what I went at as an extensive piece of research body showing it's really what's going on in the students' minds much more than who's standing up in front of them.
Right, but you could also argue that, and I'll stop. But you've got two personalities, A and B. I mean, one of those may have prepared their students better to receive the information the way that Louis and Ellen did. It's not so far fetched.
But when we got, it gets pretty far fetched when you look in detail the amount of data they collected that showed them to be the same. I would say.
Okay.
Your next question comes from the line of Margaret Monroe with Post Media News.
Hi there. I wanted to get back to this question of the retention of the learning. Like, in the paper, does it not say that over 6 to 18 months that the retention is the same based on other research?
It says there was other research showing long-term retention. It doesn't say the retention from this study.
No, but doesn't it say the opposite? It says the retention of the interactive and traditional models.
Yeah, yes.
Is similar.
And, well, so, I mean, this is a weird sort of thing. I'm going to blame somebody else for that. The editor insisted that some of the reviewers wanted that paper to be referenced and that to be pointed out. You know, I explained that I thought it was quite a different situation and a different comparison and measuring a different sorts of learning, and it wasn't appropriate, and the editor insisted it be put in, and so it leads to confusions just like I was worried about. It's just a mistake to carry that too far for looking at that work relative to this work. And
but does your work at UBC in Colorado show that there is better, like, given that you've transformed these classes, do you see a better retention?
We do not have any data on the we don't see differences in the amount of retention. Whatever the learning that was achieved in the transform versus the traditional lecture, at least, but the only kind of learning we've measured there is these very general concepts and how they're applied. And so those seem to be the same either way. And we have suspicions, and Louis has a little bit of data, but really not enough to make any claims about, that if you get into more factual learning, the interactive is probably better retention, but I don't think we're ready to... Louis, you're not ready to stand up and say,
no.
you got
no
results here, stand behind there, yeah, right, so...
All right. Could I have a follow-up question, sort of related?
I'll just leave it by saying, the points you raise are really important, and it's a thing we'd love to study in more detail. But we're just giving you the status of what the data shows so far.
And as a follow-up, I wonder if you could say whether or not, like, is this something you want to see, a wholesale transformation of the science faculties across, you know, the planet, by the sounds of it, or is it something that's going to complement traditional teaching, or do you really want transformation everywhere, including high schools? I'm just curious about.
Oh, I mean, this is clearly more effective learning. Everybody should be doing it. Yeah, it should be wholesale transformation. You're practicing bad teaching if you're not doing this. That's what the data says. High time. We've met everybody changed.
Thanks.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. Your next question comes from the line of Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press.
Thanks for doing this. A couple more quick questions for me. This was, you know, obviously the change was in week 12, and forgive me, it's been a long time, but was there a week 13, 14, 15, et cetera? What happened then? Did you go back to instructor A, or were they, what were the result, or did you keep with this method, and what were the students, did you talk to them about their reaction to the changes back? And finally, I want to make sure I assume this right, was this 3 1-hour lectures or 2 1.5-hour lectures? I assume it was not 1 3-hour lecture for that week. Thanks.
Maybe I can start.
Yeah.
To answer the last question that you asked, yes, those were 3 1-hour lectures. Actually, the control section, it was 2 1.5-hour lecture, which totaled 3 hours in the week. And the experimental section was, just because of scheduling, was 3 1-hour lectures, which totaled 3 hours. So it's important to mention that both sections that are involved in this study, the experimental and control, they were taught in the same way, that is traditionally until week 12. And in week 12, the control remained the same, but Ellen and I stepped in for a week. And then the last week of class was week 13. So there was only 1 week of class. After that, there was the final exam. And in that last week of class, we did two things. We tested the students in both sections with the test of learning, you know, just to measure how much learning took place. And that test of learning, you know, had been vetted by everybody involved, all the instructors. And also, we asked students, you know, a bunch of questions about, you know, what they thought about this week. That was only in the experimental section. So we asked them if they thought, you know, all their courses should be taught in this way, if they think they would learn more. And as mentioned in the paper, the overwhelming majority of students said yes, we would prefer, you know, having all our courses taught that way. And, you know, other questions like, did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy this interactive style? And 90% of students, for instance, agreed to that. So,
okay, then to follow up on that, the 3 one-hour lectures, one, going back to my colleague at the Times point, you know, that's another variable, you know, 1 hour lectures versus 1.5 hour lectures. You're looking at attention factors here, so are you take that into effect? And two, when you're talking about attendance during an experiment, in the paper you talk about 75% in the experimental section during experiment. Did you see, do you have the breakdown of session 1, session 2, session 3? In other words, did you see a much higher, did as the three lectures went on, did the attendance peak during that week, at the end of the week?
It was pretty stable. In fact, in the paper we put error bars there, plus minus percentage, and that's to account for the variation from class to class, and there was very little variation. And I'm trying to remember the other question you asked. I'm sorry.
Well,
I can.
Okay.
You asked one of the things, the data they collected before the experiment is, I think, the answer addresses the concern that you have, which is an appropriate one of, you know, does how much better is a 1.5 hour versus a separated 1 hour? And this is something that's actually debated a lot in university scheduling, because the, you know, if it's 1 hour, that's really 50 minutes, and there's time to settle down, and then they start getting antsy before the end, and so you actually have, you kind of cut, you know, you're worried that that's a less efficient use of time. On the other hand, you know, if they're in there for an hour and a half, you worry they're losing attention by the end. So the paper didn't focus on this, but in fact, the detailed numbers are in there that they, Ellen and Louis and the others they worked with, collected data on both sections for a couple of weeks before the experiment, looking at the attendance and looking at the engagement during class. You know, how if students started to drift away and get disengaged. And it's interesting to see that in fact they got exactly the same numbers for the 1.5 hour as they did the 1 hour section. So it appears that it doesn't make, I mean, that's not a result I necessarily would have guessed, but it appears that they seem quite equivalent in that regard.
Okay, and one last one. Since you had the final exam in week 13, was there a difference in the results the results of the final exam? You gave us the midterm scores showing, hey, that going into this they were pretty much normal. So granted, you were only talking about 1 out of 12 weeks of instruction in this method. Was there a difference in the ultimate final exam, not the CLAS score, the BEMA score, or whatever, but the final?
Sure. Actually, we did. We don't have the information on this, and you know, we did not even try to get that information, chiefly because the final exam, you know, pretty much had nothing on that week that we taught. So, you would think that proportionally, if there are, 12 weeks in the term, and we taught the 12th week, then there should be 1/12 of the final exam that covers the material during that 12th week, during that study. But that was not the case. In fact, the last several years, before that particular semester, the material we covered in week 12 was not covered. So it was actually, it's not unconventional by any means, in other electricity and magnetism courses, but for that particular course, they're not used to covering that material, and they weren't prepared to have that on the final exam. So that's why.
So just so you can have an appropriate perspective, remember, Louis and Ellen weren't in charge of this course. There were two other instructors in charge of this course, and, they just persuaded to do this experiment in 1 week, but the instructors worried about the final. And the other thing is, the final actually wasn't the 13th week. It was, I think, 3 or 4 weeks, like a month later, actually. So that also makes it a little less useful to look
at. But
I
guess if the idea is to make them think like physicists,
yeah,
wouldn't, you still have an effect if it isn't the actual testing? Or the other thing is, this is a data point like the other stuff showing that, hey, these are really similar kids, so it was that week. So I guess I'm just highly suspicious when a key data point isn't there.
It's, that's just a constraint of the situation, is all I can say.
Okay.
And also, if I may add, since, like Cross said, we didn't have any control over the final exam, it would have been nice to have extra data, but it just wasn't there. And if part of your question is, well, okay, fine, how about you look if there are any effect whatsoever on the final exam, which did not cover the material in week 12, but still, did the students in the experimental section still did better somehow? Well, of course, we don't know the answer to that, but you have to think about the effect on the students of their experience during the study. This would be diluted quite a bit by the fact that, learning over the whole term, a lot of it took place outside of class, for homework and exam studying. So if there was indeed an effect on the final exam, we would expect it to be very small for that reason.
I guess the other thing is just to keep in perspective the goal of this study, which was really to look at the learning that takes place in class. As I said before, there's been other research in other ways that do look at the cumulative things over the whole course. Of the references, look at that. And now, if you're looking at sort of conceptual learning, there's typically things like a factor of two, and the focus of this study really was to probe just what happened in this class and, the learning that takes place in this. So, the questions, and I'm not saying the things you're asking aren't unreasonable, they're just another study that, one looks at more detail there. But.
Okay. Thank
you. Looks like we have two more questions.
Your next question comes from the line of Roseanne Scorble with Voice of America.
Did the students know that they, in the experimental class, that they were undergoing, they were part of a study?
Ellen? Go ahead, Ellen.
So the students, I would say they did not know that they were part of a study, but on one hand, it's not unusual for an instructor to, slightly change the way that they're teaching, and as far as ethically, at this point, it was unknown whether this would actually produce such different results. So it seemed reasonable that this study could happen.
And if I may add, the instructor for the control section you know, when you think about this, he was quite a sport, you know, to go along for this learning competition, right? So I remember distinctly that he was actually convinced that his section, you know, with traditional teaching, would do better than the other section, and his main argument was that he would say, look, you with your activities and students taking time to debate, you know, these scientific ideas takes time, whereas me, when I teach in the way I do, I can cover the material faster, and therefore I can go in more depth. So he used to tell me, therefore I think that my section is going to do better. So that's one thing. And the other, the students were not told at all that there was a study going on. In fact, the way we explained our presence when we came in is to say, is to tell them that that we had noticed in upper level physics courses that this particular topic, which is usually not covered in that course, you know, needed to be covered because students in upper level courses struggled with these ideas. So we intended to cover that, and also this particular topic is notoriously difficult. So the reason we gave students for being there is that the instructor asked us to come in and teach the material in a more interactive way because the material is indeed so difficult to understand. So that's basically the explanation the students were given, which actually is true.
Mm-hmm. So that you could report the data, did you videotape everything and transcribe it? How did you collect and quantify the data? I know you said before that you gave them tests and there was they reacted to certain questions afterwards, how did you go about collecting and quantifying your data?
How did we go about doing that? Well,
yeah.
The most important part of well, in my opinion, of the experiment, there's a lot of data in this experiment, but one of them is the test of learning, where we try to measure the amount of learning in the control section and the experimental section. So that was given the immediately after the week ended, and students were given, you know, each were given an exam, and, you know, they would circle the correct answers, and these would be graded. So that's how we gathered that particular data. Now, the other data that's also important is the engagement during this, you know, this study. That is, how engaged were the students in the control section versus the experimental section. So for this, we train some observers on a not so well known because it's fairly recent, but on a fairly robust, you know, technique to observe. Being able to tell quantitatively students are engaged or not. So we train observers during that study, during that week, to come in and observe the classes. And also we did that for a span of 2 weeks before the experiment, just to see if there was a change. And also an important part of that study is the students' reaction and their opinions of what happened in the experimental section. And that was an online survey that was given to them.
And you had mentioned that the instructor who was so convinced that his methods were better, does he know the outcome of the study? And if so, what were his reactions?
Well, in fact, initially the person was quite surprised. And I remember it took about a month or two where... I would speak to that instructor quite regularly, and he would debate, you know, what he thought took place, and, you know, trying to find reasons why. But after a month or two, he became in fact so convinced that his approach, traditional teaching method, was ineffective as compared to the other approach, that this year, and this is someone with over 30 years of teaching experience, this year he's actually learned from me and other STLF in the Science Education Initiative. He's actually learning how to transform a course like this.
Thank you very much.
All right. Do we have one final question, operator?
Your final question comes from the line of Ann Tobin with the Canadian Press.
Yes, hello. I'm wondering if you think this transformation in teaching is required because students themselves have changed in the last 30 years. They've been raised with computers and all the interactivity that's involved with working on a computer, not to mention video games, as compared to their parents who perhaps more passively sat in front of a television screen, and so maybe a lecture would do it for them. Does it just plain take more to get students engaged nowadays?
So I think the answer is no, there really isn't any difference. I mean, if you sort of dig into the research literature, you can really trace learning back to brain development. And, you know, the cognitive psychologists, and actually even nowadays, recently, the brain researchers will show you how learning really happens only if you have this very active, intense engagement. And that seems to basically be a property of the human brain. We don't have data from 50 years ago, but I'm quite certain that the basic biology of the brain doesn't change, and that this is really what all the brain research would say is critical for learning. So I think it's probably almost certainly been the case that lectures have been equally ineffective for centuries, but now we've figured out ways to do it better.
Okay.
Now, you know, having said that, if you look at what a good personal tutor does or a good apprentice model, they're doing exactly the same things in terms of giving the person test questions, problems, and giving them feedback. And this is simply an effort to figure out how to do that in a large classroom. That's another reason to see that it's really not, in some sense, not that different and unique. It's just figuring out how to do it in this scale and this context.
Okay, well, I'd like to say thank you again to our speakers and my host at UBC here in Vancouver. Again, all information discussed during this event remains under embargo until 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, Thursday, May the 12th. Audio from this teleconference will be posted to the Science Press Package page on the Eureka Alert website as soon as possible today. The paper is also available there. Please contact SciPac at AAAS.org for any further details. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.